Habakkuk 2, page 786. We'll be starting in verse 6. Shall not all these take up their taunt against him, with scoffing and riddles for him, and say, woe to him who heaps up what is not his own, for how long, and loads himself with pledges? Will not your debtors suddenly arise, and those who will make you tremble? Then you will be spoil for them, because you have plundered many nations. All the remnant of the people shall plunder you, for the blood of man and violence to the earth, to cities and all who dwell in them. Woe to him who gets evil gain for his house, to set his nest on high, to be safe from the reach of harm. You have devised shame for your house by cutting off many peoples. You have forfeited your life. For the stone will cry out from the wall, and the beam from the woodwork respond. Woe to him who builds a town with blood and founds a city on iniquity. Behold, is it not from the Lord of hosts that people labor merely for fire, and nations weary themselves for nothing? For the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the glory of the Lord, as the waters cover the sea. Woe to him who makes his neighbor drink. You pour out your wrath and make them drunk in order to gaze at their nakedness. You will have your fill of shame instead of glory. Drink yourself and show your uncircumcision. The cup in the Lord's right hand will come around to you, and utter shame will come upon your glory. The violence done to Lebanon will overwhelm you, as will the destruction of the beasts that terrified them. For the blood of man and violence to the earth, to cities and all who dwell in them. What profit is an idol when its maker has shaped it? A metal image, a teacher of lies. For its maker trusts in his own creation when he makes speechless idols. Woe to him who says to a wooden thing, awake, to a silent stone, arise. Can this teach? Behold, it is overlaid with gold and silver. There is no breath at all in it. But the Lord is in his holy temple. Let all the earth keep silence before him. This is God's word. You may be seated.
Woe to him who heaps up what is not his own. Woe to him who gets evil gain for his house. Woe to him who builds a town with blood. Woe to him who makes his neighbors drink. Woe to him who makes a wooden thing. It's enough to make your eyes glaze over. It's like, what does this mean? And how is this relevant to this audience this morning? And that's the challenge before me this morning. When we are finished, it is my hope that you will see what this passage meant to Habakkuk and what this passage can mean to us. So in order to achieve both objectives, it's kind of necessary for us to step back. We need to back up and we need to look at the book of Habakkuk as a whole. We need to look at it with a wide lens. So in Habakkuk 1, 1 through 4, Habakkuk did not like what he saw the people in Judah doing. These people were dishonest. They robbed the poor. They failed to worship. They failed to address the injustice in the nation. They were immoral. Does it sound familiar? And Habakkuk was displeased. He simply did not like what he saw the people of Judah doing. So now at this point, we kind of have a little bit of an interpretive difference. Some view Habakkuk as pleading to God. He's praying that God would bring a revival. Some view Habakkuk as fuming with anger because God appears to be doing nothing about the problems in Judah, and that is his job. I took this tact last week. Derek in the sermon, the first sermon on the series, took the first tack. His was a plea of an honest man. I took the plea of an angry believer. It's important for you to realize this. There are numerous credible sources and commentators on both views. Know that whichever view you lean towards in this passage, it will not change the outcome of the book. And I'll explain that in just a moment. So now in chapter 1, 5 through 11, God finally responds. Instead of answering with a work of revival, that's what Habakkuk was praying for, God answers with a work of judgment. Instead of bringing Judah back to its glory days, God plans on wiping them out. And the terrorists, or the instruments of his judgment, are the terrorists of the day, the Chaldeans. And for those of you that were not here last week, I made up a fictional story of an American pastor who comes back from a conference and he's praying for God to address the sin of America. He's praying that God would turn America back, God would turn America back to him. He was praying for revival. But instead of answering the fictional pastor's prayer, God answers in a stern voice, I'm going to send ISIS to judge America, to punish and purge this nation for its sinfulness. This was merely to give you an approximation of how stunning God's answer was to Habakkuk. He wants revival, and God just says, I'm going to destroy it. How many of us are praying that God would turn us back? But if God vocally said, I'll take care of this, I'm just going to wipe it out. I'm going to kill it off. This is dead. It's done. That's how Habakkuk responds. So we saw in these first 11 verses how faith in God requires trust, despite God's silent and senseless behavior, God's strange and surprising answers, and God's savage and sordid instruments. In essence, in these first 11 verses, we saw faith grappling with problems. In chapter 1, 12 through 17, Habakkuk responds to God's strange and surprising answer. And again, at this point, we have two interpretations of Habakkuk's attitude. Some think that Habakkuk is questioning God because his answer does not appear to be consistent with God's behavior. Some think that Habakkuk is querulously, contentiously questioning God. And that is the viewpoint that I adopted last week. Again, know that whether you take the first tact or the second, it will not change the outcome of the book. I will explain in a moment. So sounding more like a lawyer than a prophet in these verses, Habakkuk tries to set forth three impressive arguments, which are all based upon God's character and are meant, in my opinion, are meant to tell God he is wrong. He cannot do what he is proposing to do. And the reason I think that Habakkuk is being contentious is every one of his reasons is wrong. It seems right, but they're flawed. In verse 12, Habakkuk argues that since God is eternal, God's promises must also be eternal. God made a covenant with his people Israel. He promised Abraham that he would become a great nation. He promised David that he would have an eternal kingdom. Therefore, in Habakkuk's mind, Israel cannot cease to be a nation. But he forgot and he didn't understand that God's promise was never to preserve a nation. It was only to preserve a remnant. And you see these verses up here. In verse 13, Habakkuk reminds God that he is righteous and that a righteous God cannot use unrighteous means. Unfortunately, Habakkuk must have completely forgotten that in chapter 28 of Deuteronomy, God promised to use foreign nations as a chastening rod if they were disobedient. In verses 14 through 17, he comes up with his third argument that reminds God that God hates and forbids idolatry. And as such, we cannot allow idolaters to take out the nation of Judah. But unfortunately, he has forgotten history, because God's past use of idol worshipers like Egypt, Edom, Midian, Ammon, Philistia, and Assyria had been used by God to judge his people. So not knowing that his arguments are clearly flawed, Habakkuk waits for God's answers. And Habakkuk has challenged the intentions of the Lord as they were revealed to him. In essence, he says, how is it possible that the Almighty could treat humans as though they're fish of the sea? Is the brutality of the invading oppressor to go on forever? Are you going to let these Chaldeans just take up nation after nation after nation without showing mercy? So this dialogue of protest that Habakkuk has, that he starts in chapter 1, has to find a resolution. This bold challenge of God's integrity must be given an appropriate answer. So, following a common Israeli wisdom quest where you argue back and forth with God and you see an increasing state of I'm going to tell God why he's wrong. You saw that in Job. You'll see that in Proverbs. Habakkuk prepares to respond to the reproof that he knows that he's getting ready to have. Notice in 2:1, I will take my stand at the watchpost and station myself on the tower and look out to see what he will say to me, and I will answer concerning my complaint. So in effect, in 1:12 through 2:1, you have faith grasping at the solution. So whether you really see Habakkuk as a godly man struggling to understand God's plans, and that's a valid perspective, or if you see Habakkuk as a believer who's openly and incorrectly challenging God, in chapter 3, we see a different man, and you get to the same place. We see a different man. In chapter 3 is a personal prayer. It is a psalm that is to be used in worship. And that's actually the meaning in verse 1 of Shiganath. It is a psalm to be used in worship. That's what chapter 3 is. Notice in verse 2 of chapter 3, Habakkuk humbly accepts God's announcement of the terrible judgment coming on to Judah. He says, I see it. You're going to do it. You're going to destroy it. But God, please, in wrath, remember mercy. In verses 17 and 18, Habakkuk no longer is questioning God, or if you take the different view, he's no longer opposing God's use of the Chaldeans to bring disaster upon Judah. See, we get to the same place. But rather, Habakkuk praises God. Verse 17, though the fig tree should not blossom, nor fruit be on the vines, the produce of the olive fail, and the fields yield no food, the flock to be cut off from the fold, and there be no herds in the stalls, yet I will rejoice in the Lord. I will take joy in the God of my salvation. There is something incredibly powerful about what Habakkuk has just said. Despite the fact that he recognizes that the truly righteous in Judah will be caught up in this looming disaster when the Chaldeans come. Not all of them are going to survive. When the Chaldeans come in, the unrighteous and the righteous can be potentially swept up. Despite all that, what does he do? He praises God. So it might make a little more sense of what Habakkuk just said in this psalm if I put these terms in sense of more contemporary terms. Since most of us do not measure our well-being in terms of figs, fruits, and flocks. So if God were to announce the same type of judgment upon this nation, we might say, though my Social Security fund is depleted, though the stock market crashes, though my insurance company goes bankrupt, though my bank account vaporizes, though I lose my job, though I will be homeless, I will rejoice in the Lord. I will find joy in the God of my salvation. What happened to Habakkuk? In chapter 1, the prophet demands justice. In chapter 3, the prophet pleads for mercy. In chapter 1, the prophet questions or challenges God's way of dealing with the wicked. In chapter 3, the prophet finds himself on his knees in prayer. In chapter 1, Habakkuk is questioning or protesting against God. In chapter 3, he joyfully praises God. So something very dramatic happens to the prophet in the course of the book. The man in chapter 3 is not the man in chapter 1. The key to understanding the message of Habakkuk is found in chapter 2, verses 2 through 20. It is to understand the process by which God changes the prophet's attitudes and actions. The answer is found here, and it's given in two parts. The first part is found in Habakkuk 2, 4, and 5. God states there are only two kinds of people in the world. There are those who are proud and whose souls are not right, and those who are righteous and live by faith. Those whose souls are not right, as we discussed last week, are the proud. They trust in themselves for salvation. They believe that their good works are sufficient to save them. They disdain grace. They see it as a form of charity, something that they neither want nor need. But on the other hand, those who are saved have ceased to trust in themselves, in their goodness or their works. They trust in God. They know that He alone can save them from their sins. They humbly accept His provision for salvation. They live their lives trusting Him and obeying His word. And we discovered last week that the justified man by his faith shall live. That was God's answer to Habakkuk's concern about the righteous. But Habakkuk has an unanswered question. What about the proud? I mean, you're talking about the righteous, yeah, the justified man by his faith shall live. Man, but we got these bad guys out here, these Chaldeans who are coming in, they're going to wipe us out. When are you going to take care of them? What about the proud, God? In chapter 2, verses 6 through 20 that Derek just read, God finally addresses Habakkuk's question, or we can say Habakkuk's concern about God's plan to punish the proud, the unrighteous. Today we're going to look at this passage. This is the second part of God's assertive answer to Habakkuk's querulous question. The theme for today's sermon is the righteous response for the purposefully proud. The righteous response for the purposefully proud. This is going to enable us to get back and answer just two questions. What does this passage mean to Habakkuk? And how does this passage apply to us today? If you begin to look at, there are three things you need to understand in this passage that was read earlier. The first one is, this is a taunt song. 2:6 through 20 is a taunt song. It uses a remarkable number of literary devices. It uses assonance and alliteration. It uses words with double meaning, thinking double entendre. It appeals to proverbial truth. It has retribution phraseology. It has rhyming phrases, all of which is completely lost in the translation from Hebrew to English. So, in other words, you see none of it. So if you want a more modern day example of what a taunt song would be, join with me, particularly when the guy fouls out at the end of the game or the team is now losing. You go what? Na 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 na, na 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 na, hey, 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 goodbye. This is a taunt song. 2:6 through 20 is a taunt song. That's the first thing you need to know. The second thing you need to know is the Hebrew word hoy does not precisely mean woe. That's kind of the best word that we can ever come up with, which is what we see in almost every normal English translation. it really connotes something a little bit broader in Hebrew. It's really kind of an exclamatory, aha, gotcha. That just doesn't translate very well into English. So every English version uses woe, so we'll use it too. So that's my second comment. Number three, this taunt song does finally provide the long-awaited answer for Habakkuk to his prayer that the evil Chaldeans be punished. In fact, this taunt song achieved my first objective that I stated earlier. It explains what the passage meant to Habakkuk. But there's a catch. And Habakkuk was caught off guard, but there's a catch. Those who do not live by faith are the proud. Unfortunately, the proud in this case involve both the evil Babylonians and the unrighteous and proud that were in Judah. Let us look at the first woe, verse 6. Woe to him who helps up what is not his own. This speaks to ill-gotten gain. Verse 6 speaks to ill-gotten gain. God is picturing Babylon here as deceptive money lenders who are overloaded with the debts to the nations they have conquered. You see that kind of there in 6, loaded with pledges. In verse 7, God says that the day is coming when this great debt that they have accumulated through their wars and their empire seeking will be collected. There is a day coming when a remnant of those who they have pillaged will pick them up, shake them violently, think turning them upside down like trying to get money out of their pockets. That's what the Hebrew word tremble means here. Tremble, I'm going to shake them until they tremble. Shake them to get the money out of them. In effect, we see in this first woe, the pillager shall be pillaged. But before we go any further, these woes are going to be very easy to apply to Babylon, to Chaldea. They may even be easy to apply to those who are unrighteous, immoral, unjust in Judah. But what about us? That brings me to my second objective today. How does this passage apply to us today? I want, as we go through each of these five woes, to ask ourselves as individuals, how do these woes maybe apply to us? Do we think, for example, in this case, that we are getting away with ill-gotten gain? It may be borrowing what we can't repay. It may be living at a standard beyond our means. It may be taking from others what is theirs. It may be taking and overselling a product or a service. It may be simple as desiring a lifestyle beyond that which God has granted. Woe to ill-gotten gain. Let us look at the second woe. Woe to him who gets evil gain for his house. The second woe in verse 9 speaks to injustice. The Chaldeans became covetous. They resorted to unjust means to enlarge their portfolio, and they placed themselves beyond the possibility of ruin. Look at verse 9. God describes them like eagles. Eagles who go up to a high mountain and they put a nest high up in the mountain. Why? They think it will be impregnable to any predators. If they go up on a mountain, if they go up high enough, no one can get to them. God says to this great empire, you may set yourself up like an eagle upon a mountain and think that nobody's going to touch you and that no one's going to get you, but woe to injustice. In verse 11, we read that the very stone of their habitation, their house, will cry out from the wall, and the beam from the woodwork will respond. In other words, the very masonry, the very timber of their house will testify to what the Chaldeans are doing to those around them. Do you remember the story of Cain and Abel? Cain kills his brother Abel. God summons Cain and asks, "Where is your brother?" Cain answers, "Am I my brother's keeper?" Do you remember what God said? "The voice of your brother's blood cries to me from the ground." There is the blood of millions of unborn babies. There is the blood of millions of the exploited poor. There is the blood of millions of persecuted Christians. God has heard these cries. And one day, he will demand an answer. In effect, the fortified will be dismantled. Let us look at the third woe. Woe to him who builds a town with blood and founds a city on iniquity. So in verse 12, you see very clearly the third woe deals with iniquity. Here the people have gone from ill-gotten gain to injustice to iniquity. Not content what they had, they add wickedness to their ledger. This is ill-advised, because look in verse 13. "Behold, it is not from the Lord of hosts that peoples labor for fire and nations weary themselves for nothing." What is he saying here? What does this mean? The Chaldeans continue to build a bigger and bigger city. In fact, they would take debris from other cities they destroyed and put it in as the foundation upon which they built their own city. They, in essence, took the spoils of others and used it as their foundation stone, not realizing that one day it would make a really, really good bonfire. In effect, the wicked will one day be wiped out. Look at the fourth woe. "Woe to him who makes his neighbors drink in order to gaze at their nakedness." The fourth woe speaks in verse 15 to intoxication. The Chaldeans were characterized by drunkenness. Their culture was characterized by drunkenness. They fueled their attacks with alcohol. That's historically proven. They exposed the nakedness of their victims. They would take their victims and push them across naked to expose that. And you may remember they celebrate their victories with drunken orgies. Daniel 5. Remember that story in Daniel 5? Take a look at it. "But be warned," God promises in verse 16, "that their fill of shame instead of glory." In effect, the shameless will one day be shamed. So by now you've had these four solemn sayings that have been hung as ill omens about the neck of the Chaldean as well as the unbelieving Jew in Judah. Each one has been threatened with severe judgment. The pillager shall be pillaged, the fortified dismantled, the wicked will be wiped out, the shameless shamed. But now we get to the last woe. This is the woe where the Chaldeans receive a message of absolute certainty concerning the outworking of God's righteous purposes. No gods, no powers in heaven or earth can stand against the reality of the one true living God. "Woe to him who says to a wooden thing." So the final woe in verse 19 is the woe to idolatry. It is clear that this involves much more than the mere simple idolatry of an individual bowing down to a wooden idol. It involves the Babylonians' whole religious system with its divination, sorcery, spiritism, and demonism. Woe to idolatry. Let us pause for just a moment. Do you have idols in your life? Most of you are thinking, "What are you talking about? I don't have any idols. I don't have any little wooden or stone things I put up on my mantle. You know, I'm not bowing down to some stuffed animal." What do you think I am, a pagan? Well, if you don't think that you have idols, think again. In his article, Identifying Your Idols, which was discussed earlier in the spring, Tim Keller asked three questions to help you identify the idols that you have in your life. Question number one, If you are angry, is there something too important for you? Is there something that you're telling yourself, I have to have, and that's why I'm angry? Because if I'm blocked from having something I want, then I'm going to be mad. What about the power of the idol of power? What about the idol of control? What about the idol of comfort? If you don't get the power you want, if you don't get the comfort you desire, if you can't get mastery over your life, do you get mad? Do you get angry? What about question two? If you are fearful or badly worried, ask yourself, is there something too important for me? Something I'm telling myself that I have to have? Is that why I'm scared? Because something that I have to have is being threatened. And I think it's a necessity when it's not. Do you have the idol of image? Do you have the idol of dependence? The idol of materialism? And if you don't get the image you want, you don't get the person you need to protect you, you don't get to have the standard of living that you must attain, that you become fearful or worried. Question three, if you are depressed, is there something, ask this question, is there something too important to me? Something I'm telling myself I have to have. Is that why I'm so down? Because I've lost or failed at something when I think it's a necessity when it really isn't? What about the idol of achievement? What about the idol of the inner person? What about the individual person? What about the idol of the inner ring? And if I'm not recognized for my accomplishments, if I don't have the one person in my life that I have to have, if I can't get into the group or the organization that I need, I'm depressed. Do you have the idol of approval, independence, work, family, privacy, ideology, affirmation, success, just to name a few others? Do you have idols in your life? Absolutely. We all have idols in our life. And if you're not sure, ask these three questions. Are you angry? Are you fearful? Are you depressed? Now, some of you are going to say, well, does that mean that I can't ever be angry? I can't ever be worried? I can't ever be depressed? I didn't say that. You can be for righteous reasons. But I would challenge you. The last time you were angry, worried, or depressed, was it for a righteous reason? Or was it because, as Paul David Tripp says, someone messed up my kingdom? But more often than not, when we are angry, fearful, or depressed, we have elevated something or someone to the position of an idol. We've elevated it to a position that makes it more important than our worship of God. Back to our text. Let's look again at verse 20. But the Lord is in his holy temple. Let all of the earth keep silent before him. This is tremendous. There may not be a word of exhortation, encouragement, direction, or anything from a dead idol, but there is a God in heaven who knows what is going on, who knows our heartaches, who knows our concerns, our temptations, our tribulations. There is the Lord Jehovah who is in his holy temple. Let all the world keep silent before him. Christian, take encouragement. God is on the throne. He is in the driver's seat. And he will answer Habakkuk's prayer in his own time and in his own way, as will he answer our prayers in his time and in his own way. So before we close, let me review the two questions that I posed at the beginning. What did this passage mean to Habakkuk? This taunt song was Habakkuk's long-awaited answer to his prayer that the evil Chaldeans be punished. God will destroy the Chaldeans and all who were unrighteous. God will punish the proud. And sure enough, not many years later, God wipes the Chaldeans out when the Persians come roaring in. Number two, how does this passage apply to us today? We see how God will punish ill-gotten gain, injustice, iniquity, intoxication, and idolatry. If any of these are resident in our hearts or our lives, be assured that we will be held accountable in this life and for sure in the next. This is the righteous response for the purposefully proud. So in closing, I'd like to address just two additional questions. Question one, do we have the right to make a claim upon God? Do we have a right to make a claim upon God? Think about that for a second. R.A. Torrey, an evangelist, pastor, educator, writer in the late 1800s, early 1900s, tells on one occasion when he was speaking on prayer, a note was handed to him. And the note said this, "Dear Mr. Torrey, I'm in great perplexity. I have been praying for a long time for something that I am confident that is according to God's will. But I don't get it answered. I have been a member of the Presbyterian Church for 30 years. I've been faithful to attend every week. I have been a superintendent in the Sunday school for 25 years. I've even been an elder in the church for 20 years. And yet God doesn't answer my prayer. I can't understand it. Can you explain it to me?" And Torrey replied, "This is easy. This is easy to explain it. This man thinks that because he's been a consistent church member for 30 years and a faithful Sunday school and superintendent for 25 years and an elder for 20 years in the church, that God is under some type of obligation to answer. That man is not praying in anything other than his name. And God's not going to hear our prayers when we approach him in that way. We must, if we would have God answer our prayers, give up any thought that we have a claim against God. If we got what we deserved, every one of us would spend eternity in hell." And Torrey continues on to complete his statement. Listen carefully. "But Jesus Christ has great claims upon God. And we should go to God in our prayers, not on the ground of any goodness in ourselves, but on the ground of Jesus Christ's claims." We clearly see this in 1 John 2:1, where we read, "We have one who speaks to the Father in our defense." The context pictures Christ as a counsel for the defense in a legal context. We're in the defense. And the bad news is we are guilty. "For all have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God." We have nothing we can claim before God to grant forgiveness for our sins. The good news is we have Jesus Christ, who acts as our advocate and is qualified to intercede for us. He can, as it were, claim his own righteousness before God, and he can ask that sinners be forgiven on the basis of his righteous act. Let's go back to R.A. Torrey's statement in light of what I just read. Jesus has great claims on God. And we should go to God in our prayers, not on the ground of any goodness in ourselves, but on the ground of Jesus Christ's claims. On to our last question. What path will you all take? The challenge presented to this chapter is very simple. Will we choose the path of the proud? Will it be the world's way? The way of ungodliness with its emptiness, frustration, and eventual ruin? Or will it be God's way? Will you accept the truth that justification, okay, being determined to be righteous, justification is only possible because of Christ's perfect work and not on our work? Will we accept his gift by receiving and not doing? Will you accept the truth that the justified man by his faith shall live? Father, we thank thee for this powerful word. In this sin-cursed world, we ask that you judge the proud and encourage the righteous. We ask for a revival. There is nothing else that will save this nation or the world that we live in. Lord, save souls here today if souls need to be saved. Bring backsliders back. Take our full commitment in surrender. We pray this in your Son's name. Amen.